This is Poetry on the Move. In this episode, I talk to the editors of Axon Creative Explorations about their latest issue, The Poetics of Collaboration. We hear poetry from Iggy McGovern, and Owen Bullock talks to Jen Crawford about her latest book, Coel. But first, poetry from Iggy McGovern. Iggy McGovern is a poet and emeritus fellow in the School of Physics at Trinity College, Dublin. In 2015, he was awarded an Alexander von Humboldt bursary to research the connection between physics and poetry at Erlangen University. He reads to us from his books The King of Suburbia and Safe House. His latest book is A Mystic Dreamer 4 by Quaternia Press.
Give and take for Owen. What would I give to hold you again in the crook of my left arm and have you hold on for dear life to the lobe of my left ear? What would you take to hold me again in the crook of your left arm and have me hold on for dear life to the lobe of your left? No, I mean the right, the one that is not pierced. The Joy Trinity. Varuna. There were three budgies in one joy, co-equal but not coexisting. The first taught wisdom through experience, seizing the chance of an open door to ascend into heaven. The second took after Father Peyton, setting up a crusading racket, joyful, sorrowful, glorious by turns, during the family rosary. The third, Mirabile Dictu, learned to say his name, the flesh made word, and had the courage to crash land on Dad's bald head, occasioning some tongues of fire.
That was Iggy McGovern, who we'll hear from more a little later. Axon Creative Explorations is an online journal of poetry, poetics, creativity and creative practice founded in 2010 at the University of Canberra. I spoke with one of the founding editors, Paul Hetherington, and associate editor, Paul Munden, about the latest issue, The Poetics of Collaboration. To introduce the journal, I began by asking Paul Hetherington about why Axon came into being.
We did it because there wasn't such a journal in the world, and we thought it was important that such a journal was there, particularly in Australia, where there are so many fine poets and so much need of more research into poetry, and particularly, I think, contemporary poetics. What are poets doing? What do they think they're doing? What kind of contribution to knowledge does that poetry make? Because I think poetry isn't just about feeling and emotion and kind of impressionistic responses to the quotidian. Poetry is actually about all sorts of deep and very subtle and nuanced issues. And we wanted a journal which could represent people's thinking and investigation around those kinds of issues. One of the great things from my point of view is that we've had a number of issues guest edited by other people, and a lot of buy-in, not only from contributors but from readers and the guest editors, people who really want to be part of the community that Axon represents.
This issue has been guest edited by Cassandra Atherton and Antonia Pont from Deakin University. What is this discussion around collaboration and poetry?
Well, I think the interesting thing, or one of the interesting things about this particular edition, is that it's titled The Poetics of Collaboration. It actually addresses so many other forms of writing other than poetry. But as with other editions of Axon, it's anchored in actual poems. And I think poetry, perhaps more than any other form of writing, is often considered to be a very solitary pursuit. And so it's revealing to see it talked about in very different terms. And even those individual poems that we've published in this edition are represented in a collaborative way, so that a poem written by a particular poet is typically read by another person who is represented perhaps as the author of an academic essay also in this edition. So there's an interplay between the poems and the essays, and indeed between the various people involved.
Do you think collaboration is becoming increasingly important in the discussions of poetry?
I think one of the great things about our connected world with the technology we've now got is that we can relatively easily collaborate. The challenge is to make that productive as opposed to just something that is rather kind of mundane.
Well, I think it is. As Paul was last week at the huge American Writing Programs conference, and there was a very interesting session there on collaboration. Someone referring to Ron Padgett, who collaborated with a number of other poets, but then also talked about, in the end, collaborating even with himself. And I think that's because in his collaborations, what he particularly enjoyed was the surprise that came from seeing where the poem went next. And I think he then attempted to produce that same level of surprise even when writing a poem on his own.
You've had a chance to engage with the issue extensively. What are some of the sort of highlights, poetically and in terms of ideas?
Well, I particularly liked Cassandra Atherton's essay about those who have been affected by the nuclear bombings in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and talking about the ethics, perhaps more than anything else, in terms of a poet collaborating with those survivors in order to bear witness. And obviously there's a huge amount of discussion around this, but I think what comes across in Cassandra's article is the importance of pursuing this kind of work as a collaborative venture, because then those that have actually experienced the horrors are represented in a way that does some justice to their own voice, but with the benefits of someone with serious skill in the craft and art of poetry, representing those experiences in a vivid and persuasive manner.
One of the things I like about the issue, a few things. One are the poems. So what's interesting about the poems is I think even though they weren't produced necessarily through a collaborative process, that bringing them together in this issue, there's a lovely sense of voices, I think, interacting in many cases. And there's a poem by Kevin Brophy called Elena, which is, I think, quite a lovely poem. And what I like about it are particularly some lines where he says, "We are building the ruins. The work is never finished. We leave almost nothing in our wake. We are building ruins upon ruins. We do this for our children. Dusk will eat the day. Night will teach us its gnomic lessons. Our bedsheets still repeat the pattern. Each morning, another crumpled ruin," and so on. And it's interesting to me that when I think of collaboration and creativity, I often do think of ruins of what's gone before us. The Romantics were preoccupied by the ruins of the ancient world. And I think in a way we're all trying to build on the slightly faded, to some extent damaged past. But you know, for me, this issue is wonderful in that it's bringing together these kinds of voices like Kevin's and the voices of some of the essays.
That was Paul Hetherington and Paul Munden, editor and associate editor of Axon Creative Explorations. You can read the latest issue free at axonjournal.com.au. Now, more from Iggy McGovern.
Proverbs for the computer age. An apple a day keeps the hacker away. Bad news travels fast. Better to light one intel than to cursor the darkness. When the mat's away, the mouse will play. Necessity is the motherboard of invention. Every blog has its day. Fight virus with virus. All that twitters is not scrolled. Let sleeping laptops lie. Beware of geeks bearing GIFs. The Bony. When I shared a bed in 1952 or 3 with my bony father, I was led to believe that we were alone. Now I can own that when his bony frame closed in upon my back and he whispered something, my name, into my bony neck, behind him lay his bony father and behind his bony grandfather, his bony great-grandfather, all that long-line boniness lying in state, their collective bony weight, pulling him down, but slow, a little heavier each year until he finally let go. And I fear he's here now with the same bony crew, light as a feathery ton. Well, they have a job to do, but not a word to my son.
Jen Crawford is a New Zealand poet who recently moved to Australia after working and living in Singapore. Her latest book of poetry is Coel, released this year by Cordite Books. She's talking about it here with Owen Bullock.
Could you tell us a little bit about the significance of the title, Coel?
So I was writing, as I think I say in the preface, I was writing in Singapore most of the way through this book, Coels were very much part of the oral landscape there. It's an amazing sound, really weird sort of ethereal sound that, I don't know, I'd heard it before, I think, in Australia. Really, that sound pinned that landscape for me in a particular way. And so we were, living on campus, there's Singaporean jungle all around. There's not much Singaporean jungle left. But it's intensely humid. There's a lot of wildlife around there. But it was, it had the feel of a shrinking space, but also a very just heavy with humidity and heavy with the activity of university life, and amongst wildlife, jungle life. So that was what was immediately attractive to me, and it was that it had that sense of a kind of a landscape. But that bird is so distinctive, that call is so distinctive.
Abandoned house music. First call. Coel. Coel, soft as police. Falling window, gaps pool, late moss. Webbed gate, caught leaves, falling galaxy. And in an inner courtyard, a coupled sun. Telescope body, expanding its creamy bows. You're standing as a gate, and yours outlines a slipper. Welcome decline. A sundrop. Coel. Red bead. Dark green.
And there's a few other motifs as well, like the egg and, by association with the bird, seeds and things like that.
Yeah,
would you like to say something about how kind of motif and repetition were important through the collection and how conscious or otherwise those uses were?
I think often in the first instance they were unconscious, but welcome.
Mm.
So I, you know, this manuscript took quite a long time to write, and I'm a slow writer, but often what's happening while I'm writing a collection like this is that I'm also, I don't know what I'm writing. I'm writing a bunch of different stuff, and then, you know, things will emerge and hang together over time, and other things will fall away. So that means that one of the things that was hanging together is these motifs that returned, that came back, that had some connection to each other.
Planet of Weeds. Wild berries underfoot. Drunken forests bend down into the shape of their children. Tallish gardens. Necklace spines, fallow brown, settle down into pale lawns. Child lawns, curled shoulders, speeding the forgetting of a forest. Air looks to being now, and then carries sight around the draped hair, casting out for sunfish, which call quickly in the deep given away. Dry lichen fields the shift between the seen unfelt and the felt unseen. A slip moon cut opens wood, soft for the flood and the drought, fear, hyphae. A line of taxis gathers spirit at the gate, that there is somewhere else to go, go on now to the mesopause, new world holding dream dots out in pressureless trade.
One of the things that really struck me about the collection was the use of space.
Okay.
And this, again, I wondered, you know, how calculated it was on your part and in certain poems, and what you feel space can do, what more space achieves, what less space achieves in terms of what you're bringing together or setting apart.
We're talking about page space?
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons that that I have a kind of a long process of sort of generating material and selecting stuff out of it is that I do lots of different things, have lots of different relationships with a page. And very often that means that what I'm writing from week to week has no apparent relation to each other and doesn't necessarily hang together
really well. Right, because you're exploring another direction now.
Yeah, and now I can't continue that. I've got to pick up something else. I'm going to pick up something else. So this is, you know, space, even in this collection as it's used here, is quite variable. But at the same time, I think there are, it's a resonant variability.
Yeah.
At least to me, that's what I was looking for.
Dots out. Does a beast stir near me? I'm alone, I'm awake. My love has gone into the dark, the house open, the wind. Gone to the garden to look for the lilies, gone to count the buds, and the savour of young fruit bitten on the trees. Print of our house upon my cheek. The spheres of our house rise, flagstones float upon the dirt. The gate's fallen open, the garden's open, the servants of the gate and the guards of the road bruise my breast. He's gone to the fields that turn to brine, he's gone to the fields on horizons of milk, gone to catch the seeds that float away.
We talked the other day about poems where there's a lot of space and the words are very spread out, and you're getting quite particular effects, and you sort of had an image, a metaphor for that, which I think
we were talking about echolocation.
That was fascinating.
Because I think particularly, you know, early in this book, the abandoned house music opens up with lots of page space, you know, short, small lines.
Mm.
You actually recently published a book of haiku, which I just loved for the fact that a haiku was allowed to sit on a page on its own, which I think it's, you know, it's hard to make that claim as a poet, I think, sometimes. Mm. It took me a while to feel that, you know, that actually there's no getting away from the fact that that's what I needed for those words. I wanted them to be ringing against the edges of the page and orienting themselves against the edges of the page, which is always, you know, and I think the edges of a page, the walls of a page are never quite, you know, they change according to not only the visual impression of words as you might see them from a distance without even reading them. But then when you do read them, they have the semantics of the words generate a relationship to imagined space.
Yeah,
and that's different in every.
I love what you're saying about the words being allowed to have that much space, and definitely there are some small stanzas in that first poem that are quite haiku like.
Yeah,
but as you say, the space means it can ring out.
Yeah.
No space, no ringing out.
Yeah. And it's almost like when you come across, when you're writing something and you come across whatever that line is, whatever that couplet is, or what it, you know, I mean, or even a single word, it's almost like you're in the dark and you don't know where the walls are. You don't know the shape of and the texture of the walls until you what's around you.
Hyphae. Lichen loves stone, a ship loves thin air, water loves a crevice seeds dry, seeds damp, stone walks into softness. The guards leave for the coast, leave for the mall, for the super colony spinning itself out around green-crossed corium, multiform darkness. Amnios and body stalk, yolk and cry. Coel. Messenger. I mother a scorching fence, I mother a child against a fence, and the cry. Here come the shell-shocked to arm the day, here come collectors for the shells. Amber cry. Of nest thief, red seed sown for others to reap.
Wordplay was another thing that struck me. Mm-hmm. Words like inelephant, indigo. Information, those kind of things.
Yeah. Right.
How important is that to you? And again, how conscious is it?
It's one of those things where, you know, like, my mind makes those stumbles all the time, and it's actually one of the things that sometimes makes it difficult to speak.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
That a lot, and a lot of the time my relationship to those sorts of errors is like, just, you know, in order to operate in the world, you ignore those kinds of errors, because you can't talk like that to people. You can't, you know, you can't stand in front of the class and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, yeah.
So it actually, you know, and Dermot Healy was an Irish novelist, wonderful Irish novelist, playwright, poet, who died a year or two ago, and I met him before he died. He's talked about what it is to actually, you know, that one of the things that's really difficult to do and really fundamental to the work of being a writer is hearing yourself, like learning to actually listen to yourself and hear yourself. It's not simple to actually hear those, you know, those errors amongst all the other things that you tune out, or that, you know, I do at least, all the inelegance and all the dorkiness and the, you know, the selfishness and the awkwardness, you know, everything, everything that is material in a way, but is actually kind of, you need a certain kind of, to be able to hear yourself in a way that actually, that it is material and that it's open and that its possibilities are there rather than just its intrusions. So that's one layer of that. And I love it when I can do that, when I can hear that.
Promise. I love you, you come back, hatches undog. Ants stream the rope out, loose husks in the hold. It must be you, come back as ants, as honeydew uneaten by ants, dripping onto the trees, sooty mould swarming over the stems and leaves. Exhausted, seasonless, vigorous cascade. Adorn me to meet you as formic acid, as shelms bleached out in an ungroomed place, the springing up of a stinging tree. A swelling belly, ruin, the lack of a canopy gap.
That was Jen Crawford. Her latest book, Coel, is available from Cordyke Books. This has been Poetry on the Move. I'd like to thank our guests Paul Hetherington, Paul Munden, Iggy McGovern and Jen Crawford. This podcast is made possible by IPSI, the International Poetry Studies Institute, and the Centre for Creative and Cultural Research, Faculty of Arts and Design at the University of Canberra. Thank you for listening.